Friends and enemies, just one thing before we get into this recording. After the show, we were talking about some of the blowups as far as like the layoffs in Bitcoin companies, crypto companies, etc. Amidst all that, Ledin is hiring, and Mario wanted us to let you guys know that if you're looking to make the jump from TradFi or from whatever you're doing over to a Bitcoin-focused company with obviously a sustainable growth strategy, contact him or go to ledin.io/careers, I think is the URL. If that's not it, I'm sure you'll find it. But yeah, he wanted us to let you guys know. If you're looking to make the jump, now's the time. These guys are they're a great company. Obviously, they've you know, sustained through a couple of bear markets now. So yeah, definitely look into that if you haven't already. And yeah, enjoy the program. The Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, the only podcast where when we can't do it on Thursday or Wednesday, we do it on a Thursday. My name is Joey, here with my co-host Len. We got a special guest tonight. Len, how you doing, buddy? It's good to see you.
Yeah, great, Joey. Living the dream. How about you?
I'm fantastic. I'm in full wedding mode here. Just got into my second beer of the night. I got a couple of friends over for dinner. So I'm skipping a nice meal here with a few of my colleagues to talk to you and, of course, our guest who needs an introduction, Mario Gibney. But before we get to our guest, Len, our sponsors, first of all, sponsored by ShakePay, best place for Canadians to buy and sell, though even on weeks like this one, you should never sell. Am I right about that?
Today is the best time to buy and, of course, never sell.
Got to be buying. ShakePay's got a couple things going on. They got the Sats Back Visa card. You can spend off your CAD balance, 2% on your first 5,000, 1% after that. No brainer. Second of all, they got the Shaking Sats. Use our promo code CBP, Charlie Beta Peter. You get $30 on your first 100. And you can shake your phone every day for 1,000 Satoshis after 365 days, which seems like a long time. But I promise you, when you get married, a year is not that long. Third, they got the Shake Squads now, Len. You can sign up with a few friends. Every purchase you make, you get 42 sats. Is it 26 or 42 sats? I think it's 42.
42 satoshis. Sats.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And I'm missing one thing there. There's four things. What is the one I'm missing? It's the...
You get $30 after you buy $100 worth of Bitcoin, you get $30. Shake your phone to get free Satoshis.
Said that.
Visa card, so the ShakePay Visa card and the Shake Squad.
Oh, what about Shake Paid ongoing? That's the other one. They might comp you your CAD spend, which is sick, in Satoshi. So if you want to add another way to save a couple of sats, that's the way to do it. Our second sponsor is Ledin. We're bringing on a pinch hitter here, a ringer, to do the read for the Ledin sponsorship. Go ahead, sir.
I'm excited to announce that today's episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is brought to you by the amazing team at Ledin.io. Ledin is a suite of institutional-grade services that can help you manage and optimize your digital wealth. Ledin pays an industry-leading 7.5% on your USDC, and you can earn up to 5.25% APY on your Bitcoin deposited on platform. Yes, you can also access Bitcoin-backed dollar loans if you need cash but you don't want to sell. And you can access a B2X loans to get a Bitcoin-backed loan to double your Bitcoin holdings. It's a great option if you need some quick cash liquidity and you don't want to sell your Bitcoin, because what's worse than selling your Bitcoin? Also, you can avoid paying capital gains tax if you don't sell. Just take out a loan, pay back the loan, and then you get your collateral back. And I'm reading about my ad read from the Unhashed podcast. And the next part, I say we've been long term Ledin clients. Which actually, I think that applies to the three of us.
Yes,
I was also a long term Ledin client before I joined the team. And we've loved the service so far. Do your own research and find out how we can help you at Ledin.io. That's Ledin.io.
Mario, could you do this again next time we have a show? We'd love to bring you on every time.
I could probably just clip that, Len.
I can give you a recording if you guys want.
Yeah. I love it.
It's good to see you, man. Thank you for coming. This is a big week, Mario, in the Bitcoin space for a number of different reasons. The lending space for a number of different reasons.
This June has been a hell of a year.
It's been a big year this month. That's right. So we solicited a bunch of questions from the viewers, listeners, and shit posters who enjoy this program. We're going to rip through them. We're going to, I think, come up with some organic discussion points off of that. And then I want to talk to you because I think you've got, you know, the sort of testicular fortitude, I'll say, my friend, to combat the Maxis on their turf on Twitter on weeks like the ones we've just had where we've seen a couple of blowups in the maximalism space. Pomp, Nick Carter most recently, depending on how you view that guy, and a few other notable personalities. So we're going to get into all that stuff. Len, do you want to start with the questions? You have a certain one you want to start on? If so, let's roll into it.
Yeah, so we've seen what happened with Celsius. We've seen what happened with BlockFi. And the price of Bitcoin, it's gone down. I think it's 18,000 last I checked my block clock, but who knows, may have gone up quite a bit. So we have a question from a longtime subscriber who is named Linda Williams. Thank you, Linda, for submitting this question. And she asks, can Ledin survive a Bitcoin low of $10,000 United States dollar?
Yes. Like simple answer. We like our business operations are not dependent on any certain price point for Bitcoin. We survived a crash like down to 3,000 a few years back. You know, we're not aping into DeFi projects with people's coins. Like we're not, you know, leveraging ourselves, that kind of thing. You know, we owe, like our business is built to withstand these types of volatility. Yeah, we've been there before. Yeah, so please say the answer is yes.
So Mario, you know, one of the questions we get in, I would say with some frequency, Alan, on the, especially on the Monday live chats, and we're talking about you guys, or obviously like when we had Corey on a couple of weeks back, the questions are about where does the yield come from? You guys have some commentary and some, you know, legalese on your site and in your TOS about that. I'm curious if you could give it to us in plain terms. Where does that, Absolutely. Yeah, you know what I mean? Where does it come from? What are you guys doing that's, you know, both safe and effective for the users?
Sure thing. Okay. So there are two products on which we offer interest. There's Bitcoin and USDC. And I'm going to talk about those each individually. So first we have Bitcoin savings. We loan out some of those coins and we get paid interest on them and we pass that interest on to clients. Some of the coins we're able to deploy ourselves. This, of course, asks the question, well, what are they doing with the coins, right? The simple thing, the general answer is there are various trading strategies that require holding spot Bitcoin. And sometimes these trading strategies require you to hold Bitcoin, but you don't want to take a directional position on it. For example, there's a basis trade, cash and carry, this type of stuff. I know there's one concern out there that people kind of assume that, well, the only way you can make money borrowing Bitcoin and paying it back is if you're shorting it, right? Now, you can short Bitcoin by borrowing. You can borrow it, hope that the price falls, and then pay back your loan, and you're in the green. But that's not the only one. That's a very risky thing to do, considering how, as much as we've seen Bitcoin can have crazy crashes, Bitcoin can also have big bull runs. So I don't believe that is a substantial portion of the of the yield from Bitcoin. There's no reason to suspect that a lot of that is shorting. Just simple fact of the matter is basic trading strategies that involve holding spot Bitcoin if you don't want Bitcoin price exposure. So that's Bitcoin. And most of our Bitcoin is the stuff that we lend to partners. We lend through Genesis Capital. I'm going to say more about them a little bit later on, given the current environment. They've been in the news a bit, so I'm going to touch on that. But yeah, we lend out through Genesis. We've been working them for a few years. They're highly transparent, very well capitalized. They have a big war chest. They publish quarterly reports. We spent a lot of time interacting with them, getting on calls with them, making sure we understand each other's risk management practices, that kind of thing. So that's our Bitcoin. It's actually, you lend it out through Genesis, and some of it's deployed ourselves with our risk team. USDC, a lot of our yield comes from our loan products. So right now, you can come to Bitcoin, to the Ledin platform. You can post a Bitcoin as collateral and accept a loan in US dollars or USDC. So we can finance a lot of those loans with other clients' deposits in USDC savings. So right now, if you want to take out a loan through Ledin, it'll cost 7.9% yearly interest plus 2% admin fee. And we offer 7.5% on our savings account for USDC. So it should be very clear that that's all in the up and up, because we make more money loaning out USDC than we pay interest on USDC in our savings account. Some of that USDC is also loaned out through Genesis. And again, similar kind of, there are various trading strategies, kind of cash and carry stuff. You can, you know, like short Bitcoin futures while longing spot Bitcoin. Like that's a valid way to make a modest return. You know, there's a reason we don't offer 20% yield on our USDC, because we don't believe that's a sustainable rate. You know, but it should be pretty clear why 7.5% is a manageable one, considering we can make more than that loaning the USDC out through Lend Loans. Now, in the last month, there's been a lot of concerns. I don't know if you guys are going to ask this in a question later on. Just I'm going to pause there.
Keep going. I think this is, you know, it's a good segue. If we do ask the question later, if there's additional details, maybe. But you know, you're heading there anyway, so you may as well continue.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So So like recently, we've seen a lot of stuff in the news about various people lending to you know, different companies and entities that have defaulted on their loans, essentially. You know, one example is 3 Arrows Capital. Seems to be kind of has had more than a few connections with other institutions where the news reports said that they failed to meet their obligations. We have never had any direct. We never loaned any funds to 3 Arrows Capital. Genesis did have a portion of its loan book lent out to 3 Arrows Capital, but they've been highly transparent about this. The CEO of Genesis did post a tweet thread about this when it happened, kind of acknowledging a loss that Genesis was able to mitigate, and they confirmed that they would not be passing any of those losses on to their clients, that is us. Leden is in we're in fine financial standing. We haven't been directly impacted by any of that.
I want to dive deep a little bit more, because you just touched on it. Genesis, do you know exactly what they do with the Bitcoin that you loan to them? Because Fringe Minority submitted a question saying that he's been hearing criticism because when they give you the Bitcoin, you send it to Genesis, they could use it on the market and potentially manipulate the market given how much collateral they have under their management. And there could be some market manipulation. Could you talk a little bit more exactly what they're doing with the Bitcoin that you loaned them?
I mean, Genesis primarily lends out to other institutions. So what they do is they, you know, we loan them Bitcoin to USDC, and they loan out to other institutions. And then the institutions will engage in these trading strategies that I referred to earlier, like kind of cash and carry basis trade type stuff. So I guess the fear that like Genesis is like, Genesis doesn't accept all of these loans themselves and then like directly deploy themselves and engage in these market manipulation. Like, I mean, that would be very much against Genesis's interest, that like it would be kind of killing the golden goose there. But they vet other institutions and lend out to them.
Mario, there's a question in the chat here from TGM that's kind of in the same vein. I don't know how difficult this will be to answer. Obviously, we didn't prep you for this. So he's interested in hearing what safeguards Leden has with the Genesis arrangement. Any oversight or control over the use of the funds that head their way from the Leden coffers? Or do you guys just have some kind of overarching legal agreement, you know, based on, I don't know, some other mechanism or some other control avenue?
Yeah, I mean, like our strategy with deciding who to lend to is if we're only going to lend to institutions that we that are transparent enough with us that we can be confident they're not doing shady stuff there, essentially. Our relationship with Genesis is on an ongoing basis, and we are continually checking with them, finding out like what their status is, what they're doing with the assets. And if it ever gets to a point where we decide that what Genesis is doing is outside of our risk tolerance, then we will stop lending funds to Genesis. That's essentially it. I mean, we're not going to loan them money if they start behaving in ways that are unstable and would and if we determine to put our clients' funds at unacceptable risk. And you know, to date, we have never lost a single Satoshi of any of our clients' funds. We're proud to say that we maintain that that status and intend to do so going forward.
So TGM, you can probably see those questions. Hey, Mario, can you see the live chat?
Yeah.
So he's hammering a couple of, I mean, pulling on a thread a little bit here that I'd be curious about some of this stuff. I know you guys have in the past made public the sort of pecking order for creditors and, you know, where things would go if there was a huge, you know, a nuclear fallout type event that caused enough contagion that you guys were affected. And there's a couple other questions here about, you know, what products specifically are you in with Genesis? Or are you just a general creditor, stuff like that? So I'm not going to read them all out loud, but if you want to rip through them, then I'd be happy to listen to your answers. I think they're good questions about where the funds are going, all this kind of stuff. And he's frequently in the Monday chat. He's got a bit of a background in, I guess we'll say institutional finance, ALEN. So he's, he's asking some questions here. I think a lot of people would be curious about the answers too.
Yeah, I'll answer what I can. I'm going to be limited partly due to, of course, we can't reveal every single bit of detail.
And
also, I would remind you that, like, I'm on the marketing team. I'm not the person on the calls at Genesis.
You're not doing that? What do you mean?
No, it's cool. I've gotten to see lots of different parts of Ledin's business, but there are limits, right? But I'm going to do my best. Yeah, so yeah, this is a lot of questions here. Just want to reassure people, we've said this in the past, it's still true now, client assets take priority in the event of any sort of any sort of loss. Like, client funds are our priority. And what's the ratio? I don't know the ratio reserves off the top of my head. I'm not sure. TGM is saying they here, so I'm not sure if that's Ledin or Genesis. But if you are curious about the Genesis numbers, again, they publish their own quarterly reports. You can go look these up yourself. Just look up Genesis, like Google Genesis quarterly report, and you can see if you're happy with that yourself. If you're not, totally understandable. But one of the reasons we operate them is for transparency. I'm not sure about the question between certain products or general creditor. As I said, not 100% sure about that one. Don't worry, TJ. I'm just reading the thing. You're not being a dick. I totally understand why people have these questions. Like, it takes a lot of trust to tend over your coins to another entity. So, like, these are reasonable things to be asking for. I think I got most of these.
You covered a bunch of them.
Yeah,
the reserve ratio thing would be decent. Yeah.
The reserve ratio, yeah, I can't speak to the exact numbers for now. I can say that it's not 100, like, sounds like this is all fractional reserve to extent. A lot of loans are collateralized. I can't speak to the exact proportion.
You touched on one word. You said trust. And the one thing Ledin, yeah, it really is. And Ledin does gain a lot of trust due to the transparency that you provide their customers. And maybe you could touch upon and go into detail about what you do to provide information to the customers. What makes you different than something else out, some other competitor in the market?
Different than BlockFi. Just say BlockFi.
Yeah.
Not going to name any competitors. but I will say, yeah, proof reserves is one of the things that makes us stand out. We were the first lender to do proof reserves. That is, every 6 months, what we do is we open our books after anonymizing all of the client data to Armanino LLP. They go through everything, make sure our books are in order, assets and liabilities all line up. They publish their own Merkle tree of all of Ledin's accounts. Again, all the data has been anonymized. And then you can take an anonymous hash ID from your Ledin account and go over to the Armanino Trust Explorer tool and verify that, all of, as of the date they did the proof of reserves, we did the proof reserves, your balance was in order. We are looking to accelerate the pace of these proof of reserves. Some clients have asked, why only every 6 months? Why not more frequently? And so, we are currently in the early process of figuring out how do we accelerate the cadence there.
Next one is due on July, right?
That's right. It's coming up in about, exactly 1 month from today. That will be the kind of when the snapshot is taken, and then it'll take some time, probably at least a week, just you know, for them to go over everything. It's not the kind of thing you want to rush. And then you'll be able to, if you had any funds on platform as of end of July, you'll be able to verify for yourself through Armanino. Other things we do, we're very we try to be as transparent as possible. Like, you know, when we have months like these, what I do is I reach out to our affiliates, like the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. I say, hey, would you guys like to have me on? Would you like to take any questions? Like, that's a big part of how we operate. We want to be accessible. You know, we encourage you to reach out to our client success team. They can answer questions directly as well. So we stay out there. We make sure that, like, you know, the channels are open. And, you know, we published a blog post at the beginning of this week reminding people, like, Lend clients are still happy leaving their funds on platform because, you know, here are the things we do to reduce risk. And it's stuff like, you know, we focus on Bitcoin and USDC. We haven't been adding a whole bunch of other tokens. We haven't been using our clients' funds in DeFi protocols, for example. You know, and again, we're not even hardline against the very concept of DeFi. It's just none of the current implementations we felt met our bar. That's one way that we've avoided getting burned in any way. And, a lot of it has to do with just practices within how we operate within the company in terms of a security and the way our tools are set up. You know, we are proud to say that, you know, we haven't ever leaked client data, had any sort of incident like that. I'm trying to think if I missed anything.
That's a pretty well-rounded answer. I think, Mario, it'd be worth talking about, if you could, you know, the nature of the interest rate push and pull that you guys offer.
Hold up. Okay. Jordab has asked me what my favorite color is. It's green. This is an important one. My favorite color is green because it's the color of nature.
That is just absolutely ridiculous. Okay. Okay, tell me about the push and pull of the interest rates, because this is another thing people are concerned about. Sure. We did a stint the other day on the show, maybe 2 weeks ago, Alan, where we talked about your competitor from the Americas interest rates on DeFi tokens.
You're allowed to name our competitors.
BlockFi. Yeah, so we talked about BlockFi's rates on some of the DeFi protocols they were on, and some of these things in the midst of a blow up that, you know, today kind of culminated in what, a 99% devaluation discount for FTX if they actually go through with it. No, we don't have to talk about that, at least not at the moment. But, you know, Mario, in the middle of all this stuff, they're still offering 20% on some of these tokens, 15% on some of these tokens, no limit, no tiering of deposits, nothing. So how do you guys come up with your rates? What is the mechanism there to decide every month? Give me a little texture on that that landscape.
I mean, it's quite simple. The rates are determined by what the borrowers are willing to pay for them, right? It's like what I highlighted before with the USDC rates, you know, that this is what we can charge clients for loaning them USDC. So here's, you know, we, you know, need to operate the business, so we take profit from that, and then we can pass on the rest to our USDC depositors. It's the same thing with Bitcoin. When there's greater demand to borrow Bitcoin and there's less Bitcoin floating around, you can expect interest rates to increase. When, you know, demand reduces or the amount of a Bitcoin on loan increases, then you can expect rates to go down. Which, okay, and I guess people are going to ask, well, what determines that? Again, a bunch of it's like a myriad of different factors. For example, like we compared to a year or two ago, USDC rates are lower. Mm-hmm. At one point, I think we were offering 10% or 12% on USDC. At the time, there was a smaller supply of USDC and stablecoins offering demand, but there's been gradually growing institutional acceptance of these products. And as such, the kind of supply of stable coins expanded quite a bit, you know, over the course of like that year or so, and fulfilled that demand. When something like this happens for example, the value of Bitcoin has decreased a lot. That may result, I have no idea if it is going to happen, but something like that could result in like Bitcoin interest rates going up. For example, if there's some sort of demand that stays constant, but like if the value of Bitcoin is much lower, then that kind of means that on aggregate, there's less Bitcoin to be lending out. So I there isn't any single factor that goes into this a lot. I mean, if you want like another specific example, like the basis trade, for example, if Bitcoin futures are trading much higher than spot Bitcoin, you know, there you can earn a reliable interest rate by selling Bitcoin futures and holding spot Bitcoin. And that's one way that, you know, borrowing an asset can produce yield.
By the way, I can't speak to why
20% is being paid on some other token.
No one can.
Offer. I can't make any comment on that. What I can comment is on where our rates come from. And I'm sure if you look around the cryptocurrency industry, you're going to find some stuff that maybe doesn't add up. And that's probably a place for caution.
I think you're right about that. Len, before we move on, I want to pull the thread just a little bit more on on communication, Mario. You guys do a good job. And you've talked about this on our show before when we were a lot smaller. Now we have a little bit bigger audience. So I'd love to hear you go through this again. When, for example, you know, a B2X loan goes south on somebody, what is the procedure there on your end? What are the communication protocols? How do you talk to those people? What options and timelines, things of that nature? You know, it's all you. Let us know what that's about.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So yeah, we've been talking about the savings products for a bit. Now we're going to talk about the loans a bit more now. We offer loans of 50% loan to value. So let's say you want to borrow $5,000, you can post up $10,000 worth of Bitcoin as collateral. So that means that after the admin fee is taken away, you have about a 52% loan to value. That means that the value that we have loaned you and that you owe us is 52% of the value of the total collateral. Now, if the Bitcoin price goes up a bunch, you're safe because the LTV, the loan to value, will decrease. That is, the amount you owe relative to the collateral will go down because your collateral is getting more valuable. Now, the opposite may happen, as we've seen in the past 2 months, where the Bitcoin price may go down. If the Bitcoin price gets dips enough such that you're at 70% loan to value, so you start off at like your amount we loaned you is 50% the collateral, but let's say the value of the collateral goes down. If this gets to 70% loan to value, then we will send out a message to you. We'll give you notification saying, your loan collateral is unhealthy. You should top it up, add more collateral to make sure it stays safe. If it gets to 75% loan to value, we notify you again. If it reaches 80% loan to value, we are forced to auto close the loan. What we do there is that we sell just enough of the collateral in order to cover the cost of the loan. So your debt is cleaned out, and the remaining Bitcoin, which will be approximately 20%, is just sent to your savings account on Ledin, and you can withdraw that.
Can you stomach? For example, Mario, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we've had kind of a slow grind down, but a few weeks ago we had, I think, at like a 10 or 12% day or 10 or 12%, you know, 48 hours. Can you guys stomach, I don't know what percentage of your B2X loans would be hampered by that kind of price drop, but can you stomach, a big drop like that without having problems on the collateral side? Or is there something people should be, I don't want to say worries. I really don't think people should be worried using your platform, but is there something people should be thinking about when those big days hit? Right, exactly.
Yeah, people
right?
should be so, cautious. They should keep an eye on the price. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like this is why we send out the warnings at 70% loan to value, right? Like, we don't send them out at 78% because you can't have these sudden price drops. Now, let's say you take out a loan at 50% loan to value, right? And the price drops like 10% the next day. Your loan collateral will still be in good standing, right? Like, in order to get to 80% loan to value, I mean, it can get there if you have the loan open for a very, very, very long time, like years, and the interest builds up. If you ignore the interest, it's close to like you would need something like a 39, 38% drop, something like that, to get that 80% LTV. So a 10, 20% drop, like, that's dangerous if you have let your loan collateral get already in kind of 60, 70, 75%, right? Which is why, like, you know, we recommend people keep a close eye on it. And this is also why when the price starts dipping, like, we'll often send out tweets kind of reminding people, hey, like, you know, here's how to keep your loan collateral healthy. But it is the responsibility of the client to keep an eye on what's going on in the Bitcoin price. We endeavor to make it as clear as possible. Like, when you log into your dashboard, all your loans are out there, the LTV is clearly displayed. We send out the messages. From a business operational standpoint, sometimes we do need to auto close loans. And the reason we chose 80% as a threshold is that that's like a heavy cushion such that we don't, we can avoid taking losses on any loans, even if there are sudden price drops.
Right. So that's the number where you guys are able to continue operations and not risk. Okay. Understood. That's good information.
Yeah. Because I mean, just imagine some hypothetical, more irresponsible lender out there, wasn't doing any checks on the people they were loaning to and had like exactly a 100% loan to value. If the price ever drops, if they're not able to sell literally instantly, they're at risk of selling at slightly less than the loan is worth. So that's why there's that cushion there. It's just to, we don't ever want to offer any product that we don't consider sustainable.
So with the liquidation process, whenever it does occur and whatever Bitcoin is left that you're holding on to, can you disclose exactly what is Ledin's strategy with the Bitcoin that you left holding on? Do you sell it? Do you keep it? I'm just curious if you can disclose
We sell it. Yeah.
You do not hold any Bitcoin when it's liquidated, and you liquidate it in totality and keep the whatever.
Ledin holds some Bitcoin on our balance sheet as reserves, but we don't when auto liquidation happens with the client's funds, we sell the Bitcoin.
Okay. And
if we were to not do that, what would happen is the amount of Bitcoin we hold would just be determined by how many, downward price swings, which, we choose how much Bitcoin we want to have on our balance sheet. So the reason we sell it right away is that we're losing this this dollar debt that we've had from someone else. So we need dollars in order to balance that out.
So in terms of the opposite then, the B2X, I know that this came to be because a lot of people were just using the loan option and simply mm-hmm. buying Bitcoin, and you just made the whole process a lot easier then. But in terms of that, when things go sour, can you talk a little bit about the B2X option? Because we've been touting it lately, especially with the price of Bitcoin being so low, too bad the price isn't being shown in the block clock. And I want you to talk a little bit more about this, especially what are the perils of it and what are the gains that one could expect from a B2X option?
The B2X, your risk profile for the B2X is the same as for our dollar loans. The process is the same. Once the loan is opened, it's functionally the same as one of the dollar loans. You're going to start off with around 52% loan to value once the admin fee is taken. And if when you close the loan, the Bitcoin price has gone up faster than the interest has, you can sell at profit. You'll end up with more Bitcoin than you started with. Your gains or losses on that are going to be largely determined by what the Bitcoin price does. Mm-hmm. And as with our other loans, because sometimes you may need to top on the collateral, we recommend that you don't do this with a significant portion of your stack. You should do this with, a fraction of it, so that you're not sweating if the price goes down, because it's Bitcoin. The price does sometimes go down.
Never does it go down. It's always going up.
I can't believe that. Yeah, I was told number go up only. So Mario, question for you, given the last week or so, and this is a difficult question to answer, but I'll ask it anyways. We've seen the only failure in the last two or three weeks bigger than the implosion of these interest accounts, the implosion of these platforms, all these messes caused by irresponsible lending and borrowing and DeFi. The only thing worse, in my view, has been the communication by these platforms. And so I'm curious, and I don't know if you can answer this. Like I said, it's difficult for me to pin down whether or not this is something you could talk about on a podcast, or even if something you guys have in place. But the incident communication strategy from Compass, for example, deleting the Discord channel and trying to stop people from talking to each other. That's my own speculation as to why they're doing that. I don't know if that's actually the case, but it seems to me the most likely outcome. Same thing with BlockFi, basically going silent. Zach Prince doing a little bit of damage control on a podcast. That's about it. If things really went sideways, Mario, or if you did have a problem with liquidity or solvency at some point, I don't want to know the details, but I'm curious if you guys have a strategy in place to address these things in a way that's more effective than the gong show we've seen across social media in the last, two or three weeks.
I mean, it's a general principle of ours just to keep communication lines open. Like that is how we've operated from day one. You don't see us going silent. We're always reachable. Especially through our client support platform, especially through doing this kind of thing. You know, we've never, I didn't follow the Compass news at all. This is the first time hearing about that. So, you know, again, I can't comment on any of our competitors, but no, this is just like a firm principle of ours is to keep communication lines open. Like the last thing you want is to have given up your coins to some entity and have no one answering when you reach out to them. Like that's not cool. That's not what we do. I don't know what else to say to that. Like, you know, we're here and it's a principle of ours to stay accessible, to stay open, transparent. You know, if people want to know something, we let them know.
I want to knock off one of the Canada Extreme questions. He submitted a couple of them, but one of them I want to touch upon because tomorrow is Canada Day. Patriotism is running high. A lot of people are reminiscing what happened in Ottawa a few months back. And the question he has is, what's going to happen if the Canadian government targets Bitcoin, and how will Ledin protect its customers should this be the case?
Right. So, I mean, I guess it would... That's a very, I guess, a bit of a broad question. That, like, what does he mean by what if the Canadian government targets Bitcoin? We are a government regulated entity, and so we're going to, you know, we are going to comply with the law. We are subject to regulations, and Ledin isn't in a position to fight the Canadian government unless there is a legal case to do so. But you know, we do comply with the, you know, legitimate requirement by law. It would not be possible to operate in otherwise.
You guys are not receiving any, I can't imagine Len or Mario that there's any real pressure on that front at the moment. Like we haven't seen anything.
I have not gotten an inkling of that.
No.
It likely would be mining companies that would get it first. I think that it's a different topic altogether, but it's probably going to be the amount of energy that it uses. I don't think they're going to target something like Ledin. Sorry, just my own comment.
You know, this is just my personal opinion. I don't, you know, with the like mining thing, my read on the Canadian government is if they see like, oh, Bitcoin's like harmful because of the energy usage, like they're probably going to do something like, you know, tax mining. That's what I would guess. Like, you saw what happened in like Quebec a few years ago, you know, enacted some laws that made it more difficult to operate for Bitcoin miners to operate there. And they kind of, you know, there's that kind of thing going on. I don't see where we would come in terms of that kind of stuff. And as I said, I haven't gotten an inkling of that kind of thing. But yeah, like, I mean, we are fully compliant. We do adhere to the regulations that are required by us because we wouldn't be able to operate otherwise.
Yeah, that's what you want out of a company like that. We've talked on the show before about the companies who try to avoid and evade regulations and you know, obeying the law, for lack of a better term. Those companies you want to stay away from. The companies who don't KYC, AML, things of that nature. At the moment, that's the nature of the beast. The landscape requires that credible companies follow these rules. And so if you're investing or you know, in your case, parking your tokens or your Bitcoin or whatever with a third party, you want that. You want that as part of the deal. Len, do we got any more questions here from the notes? What do we got?
Yeah,
we got
a few more? So I'll do another one from Canada Extreme, and it's to do with the products and building on a platform you have. And he asked, when will you be able to offer direct access to bank accounts to transfer in and funds in and out of your platform?
Yeah, you want to know maybe ask when we become an on-ramp. It is something we're working towards. We will have exciting news in the near future, but I will
sponsor battle for on ramping there for.
I'm not going to be able. I'm unfortunately not able to offer any direct timelines at present, but it is something we're working towards.
And I still have one last one from Brandon Johncast. I think I pronounced his name correctly. He was asking about the Bitcoin backed mortgages and if you could provide any details on the rates and the terms that come along with it. It's something we don't talk a lot about, and it's kind of, I know it's relatively new in the space, but I was wondering if you could shed a light on anything with this.
Yeah. Well, with the rates as well, like, you know, it's unlikely that we're going to choose a certain rate at launch and it stays there forever, right? You know, rates of any kind are going to subject to broader market conditions. So I can't promise anything in terms of rates. I am excited that we have officially partnered with our mortgage. We've chosen our mortgage partner in Ontario. I just want to make sure I got the name right. Yeah, it's Butterscotch Capital is our great mortgage name. Broker in Ontario, which I love that because I'm like, you know what? That's not a Bitcoin company. It's not. You can tell in the arrangements doing Bitcoin mortgages. You can tell who the We are the Bitcoin company with our name, and they are the normies, because you know, that's what you want. We know the Bitcoin world, and they know Ontario real estate. So yeah, we are excited to partner with them.
I got to follow up to that then.
Yeah, I mean, Len, I want to know about the traffic on these things too. Like, how much? What is the demand like in Ontario, Canada? That's really, you know, what I want to know. Not just Ontario, but Canada more broadly, because it seems to me like that's a big potential addressable market. There's a lot of people in their 20s, 30s who got a lot of Bitcoin and don't have a lot of cash, and they're probably looking at something like that.
I don't know the Canadian numbers off the top of my head. I can tell you that early on when we first launched it, we were looking at something like $10 billion worth of interest. But that was total. That was global within the first month or two, something like that. It's upwards of tens of millions. I think it's, I'm hesitant to say anything higher than that, just in case I'm wrong. But like, it's, let me put it this way. We have more demand than we're capable of fulfilling at the moment. And I'm excited to see where this goes. But unfortunately, I can't say more on that for now.
So you answered one of my questions, I think, because I was going to ask you if there's still a waiting list to get on. And the second one I was going to ask you is this, I don't know, off the top of your head, do you know what jurisdictions you offer the Bitcoin-backed mortgages in?
Ontario right now. So email us if you're in Ontario. We can start conversations there. As I said, we've chosen our official mortgage partner for Ontario. We're looking at BC next, hopefully the rest of Canada soon after. In the United States, I can't confirm for sure, but we're looking at California, Texas, Florida. But again, can't give timelines.
So then doubling back to what we were talking about earlier, I want to just go back to the whole change in the landscape of the industry in the past month. Lots of has transpired, and it's brutal what's happened, essentially. But for your customers, have you noticed there's been a change in their behavior? Have they been starting to pull out some of what they had on the Ledin platform? I'm wondering if they're reacting, given what's transpired between BlockFi, Celsius, and other platforms, and if Ledin is experiencing some sort of change in how the customers are dealing with their capital that they've placed in your trust.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's obvious for a bear market and literally the entire industry revenue.
We don't use
down.
Those words on the show, Mario.
You know, so it's a bear market, Joey. It's a bear market.
We're gonna beep them.
I love bear markets. Bear markets are the time where the winners really shine.
We're gonna talk about bear market behavior as soon as we're done with this. Okay, I promise you, sir.
we're above 19,000, gentlemen. Yeah. This is great. No longer bear.
Revenues have decreased, but like, that's to be expected, right? But again, we're built to withstand these periods, these swings. You can't build a Bitcoin business and think the price is literally going to go up forever and never have these downturns. This is not the first the first dip that Ledin has been through. I don't think it's even the most intense in terms of price. Like, I mean, look back what happened March 2020. Ledin, we dealt with that. We dealt with it last year as well. I mean, long-term guys, long time preference.
That's right. Yeah. That's the horizon can't be, immediate for everyone. So Mario, we got to talk about here your, we're going to switch off of the Ledin thing and go to some of your personal views so we can accost you and hammer you on things you believe, nice. Deeply, dearly.
That's what I come on these shows for.
So you've been honestly, Mario, you're one of my favorite Twitter followers, not just because I like you, but because you're,
but also because you like me.
Also, for sure. And people in the chat here are saying you should cut your hair, by the way. I think that long hair personally is for the summertime more than anything else. But that aside, I would say that you got some pretty strong takes on maximalism, on the role of toxicity in Bitcoin, things of that nature. And bear markets bring out the best and worst in people. And I saw you had a little back and forth with Nick Carter yesterday or the day before about his, I guess we'll call it his portfolio. I think people in Bitcoin had this like weird fever dream that he was a maximalist. I don't know where that came from. Like, anyone who's ever listened to On the Brink or knows anything about Castle Island knows that he's invested in a lot of, you know, things that I personally wouldn't invest in, but whatever, if that's what he wants to do, it's what he wants to do. I think the guy's been a net benefit for Bitcoin. Talk to me a bit about your views on toxicity in Bitcoin and maximalism. Because I got to say, Mario, I follow maybe 1,000 people, 900 people on Twitter, something like that. And man, I see your name in the replies more than I think I see anyone else's on these sort of sometimes sensitive subjects. So what are you thinking about all these things? What is the role of maximalism or toxicity in the Bitcoin space these days?
Okay. So I consider myself a Bitcoiner. Like, okay, in general, I don't like labels. Like, I'm Bitcoin focused, and you know, okay, how do I go about this?
He's a foot away from the mic, thinking about his response here, Len. For the first time in the show,
it's a good question. I wanna give it a good thoughtful answer. I guess there's like 20 different directions I'm thinking I could go with this, right? So you want to know my beliefs in this? Like, I mean, I'm Bitcoin focused. Now, that's not because I have this dogmatic belief that anything that's not Bitcoin is automatically a scam. I think that is silly dogma. However, empirically, almost all of the other stuff in the cryptocurrency space has turned out to be, I mean, depending on your definition of a scam, I think a lot of people had genuine intentions.
Scam. It's been a scam.
No, I don't think Monero, I don't think is a scam. I think Monero
would say that.
I think Monero was an interesting project. It absolutely, along certain dimensions, has better privacy guarantees than Bitcoin. But the only thing is, it comes at a very, very poor scalability trade-off. For example, you know, they also didn't do like an ICO. As far as I can tell, the people working on Monero genuinely want to build, you know, a cryptocurrency that has a great privacy properties. It was an interesting project. I'm glad people tried it. You know, for example. Now, I don't think Monero is representative of the cryptocurrency, the blockchain industry, or NFTs or ICOs as a whole. I think there's been a lot of really scammy stuff done there. I think there's also been a lot of genuinely motivated people that just have been unrealistically optimistic about their projects. And so for that reason, I'm Bitcoin focused. Also, there's just so much happening in the Bitcoin space that, you know, even though I acknowledge there might be some other interesting projects out there, you know, my time is finite, so I'm focused very much on Bitcoin. I think that is the correct view. I think that it'd be great if more people did that. But somewhere along the line, that got simplified to Bitcoin is the best and everything else is automatically bad. All right. Now, again, that's not too bad if that's your view and, like, you know, you have that and then you just work on Bitcoin, right? But where I really start to disagree with people is, like, okay, if these other things are scams, you should call them out. I'm a big fan of calling out scams and a big fan of calling out bad projects. I've, like, pointed out what I thought are a lot of bad projects before. Like, I don't think people, like, I don't hold Ethereum, and I recommend my friends don't hold Ethereum, for example. But where I start to disagree with the whole toxic maxi thing is where then the appropriate thing to do is to be as insulting as possible to anyone who's in these other projects. Now, I'm not one of these people who's like, oh, you should, like, I've insulted people before.
Have you ever heard our show? You guys are sponsoring us. Have you heard the program before?
Dude, No. Listen, I'm not saying you should never insult people. Like, go on my podcast and we insult people. Yeah, sure, it happens. It happens. You guys, it happens. Like, no. I we mock people like a ton. Don't worry. But what I have a problem with, though, is that there's this contingent of people out there that, like, their entire personality is this has been simplified to all I need to do is go around insulting people who aren't into Bitcoin, and then I'm helping, you know, and that's their entire personality, right? And then there's these, like, kind of these greater and greater purity tests that people put through, you know. For example, like, someone like Nick Carter is like who has done more than Nick at countering energy FUD against Bitcoin? Like, no, and he's done almost more, like, arguably he's done more than anyone else, than everybody else combined, right? Now, do I like the fact that he invested in this dynamic XYZ thing? Not really. I didn't look into it too deeply because I don't care that much, because just some other dude invested in it. And it's like, you know, it's not something I would invest in. But I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not BitConnect either, right? It's not, you know, so I don't care that much that he's invested in it. Nick Carter still is like vastly, like, a positive influence in terms of the kind of Bitcoin cryptocurrency world, even though I disagree with him on a couple of things. So yeah, when I see people just like, well, yeah, like, it's cancel culture, it's what it is, you know. Like, you have, like, and most of these people doing this, like, they, you know, they're these type of people who are going to be like, they consider themselves to be kind of anti-woke, or they don't like how like censorship and aggression from, like, the left and stuff, and then they just engage in the exact same topics if someone isn't like, doesn't pass their purity test for Bitcoin, right? So I don't like, I kind of, when someone's new to the space, and I'm trying to explain to them how like maximalism works. And like, this is actually a really fun part of my job at Ledin, is I get to be like the Bitcoin dude. And when someone new comes in on the marketing team who like, you know, they've got like wicked marketing skills, but they don't really know the Bitcoin world, it's great because I get to teach them all this stuff and they get to teach me like kind of, you know, like they, like I don't have a business background, so I'm learning all that stuff from them. It's great. You know, and I'll be like, yeah, listen, like I am like my views align with the maximalist on like a lot of things. Right. But I don't like that term. And I don't like, and I don't know, the word toxic thing, toxic is a bit interesting because like, I think toxic maximalism was, I think Vitalik first came up with the term maximalist to describe, you know, people. Yeah. And I don't remember if he came up with the toxic thing, but that one was a bit tricky because there are scammers out there who have tried to paint any criticism of their project as toxicity, right? They try to conflate legitimate criticism with insults. I think legitimate criticism is legitimate. You know, I would never tell someone, you shouldn't ever criticize other projects. No, you should. Absolutely. But then you have the opposite problem where people are like, oh, so their criticism is bad. So I guess that means toxicity is good. So I guess if I just go around insulting everything, then I'm like, I'm helping. And like, there are a bunch of these accounts out there who like, that's their entire personality. It's like,
Dieter Bob.
I'm not even going to bother naming any names. There's a lot of people I've muted or blocked just because I'm like, the only thing coming from your account is this angry kind of like their entire personality is insults. Right. Now, again, does that mean I think we shouldn't call out scammy stuff in the space? Of course not. Listen to the Unhashed podcast. That's all we do. Right. That's not all we do. That's like half of what we do. We also do a bit of we keep doing Bitcoin research and make really immature jokes. If that's all the value you provide, I don't think you're really helping. And then it just gets turned on people who are actually really good for the Bitcoin space, like Nick. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? Like, the excessive purity tests really bother me. It's that kind of thing.
Nick has been like not only on the energy FUD side, but I remember like a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, he was engaging with guys like Mike Green on the Tether thing. He's engaged with a number of people on a number of different subjects. I think he's pretty well-spoken and well-researched, even if he doesn't have like a cryptography, mathematics, business background. He's a guy who does his work. And it seems to me like he's been, like you said, more than a net positive. I'd also mention that my biggest beef with the Nick thing is that, you know, like I mentioned, this fever dream that people had that he was a maximalist. If you've ever read any of his stuff or watched any of his interviews or gone to the Castle Island website, like this stuff has been public for a long time. It just it shows me that the are the maximalists really so naive and so narrowly researched that they didn't know this about a guy that they, you know, put on a pedestal? It's embarrassing, I think, a little bit. But I think this is the first time in my time in Bitcoin that this kind of like blow up has happened, and it's all really because of BlockFi. Like, it seems like BlockFi is the catalyst. Like, people are hunting down anyone who said anything positive about BlockFi or took a dollar from BlockFi. Like Preston,
this happened last bear market, man. This happens last bear market. People run out of people to attack, and like, you know, like Luna's gone. No one's going after Luna, guys. Who do we go for? I guess we'll find out who. Like, yeah, I don't know. It's I saw similar stuff happening like back in 2017, 2018, like. I don't know, like, should I generally don't. I try to ignore these guys, but fuck it. I like the Samurai wallet guys, just awful. Like, they kind of made this name for themselves during the block size wars, being really hardline and pro-Bitcoin. And then kind of when that sort of died, they just started attacking a bunch of other, like, Bitcoin projects in the space. And I was like, what are you guys doing? Like, you know, so it's that kind of thing. But honestly, I try and comment on it less and less. Obviously, I still do comment on it. Maybe I shouldn't. I try and make it less direct and just like not give these people air. I kind of skimmed the piece that Nick Carter wrote. I'm like, yeah, this is correct, but why are you giving it attention? But then again, yeah. I just ranted about it for 10 minutes. So hypocrite on this end. Yeah. So I don't know. It's your fault that you asked me.
I'm clipping that for Fountain. I'm gonna get some plays off of that.
You better ask me about the non-drama stuff I've been tweeting about as well.
Gotta ask. Gandalf had a question for you about the name
Gandalf had a great question.
Answer it.
That's right. Tell
us what the question was and then answer it, because it is a good question.
You're gonna make me dig it up. I'll dig it up.
I don't know where. It's in my notification somewhere about the mining reward, right? What is the long-term name for the mining reward?
Yeah. Okay. So there's let me dig it up, because I like Bitcoin Gandalf. He's a good friend of the show. Where did he post this actually?
It's in my replies, I'm pretty sure. But
it's in your replies? He tweeted it to you?
I don't know.
Why didn't he tweet it to
dude, I wish this is like great.
This is great content.
It's great for the audio side. let's see here.
All three of us are looking. Fine. Okay, while you find the exact question, I'll give a bit of background.
Here it is. Ask him if he's figured out a name for the annual mining revenue as a percentage of total market cap. There you go.
Okay. I think we're going to want some context for people who aren't constantly following my tweets. You should be constantly following my tweets. That should be your main thing you're doing every day, listeners. But I understand that doesn't apply to everyone. One of the topics I'm really interested in is Bitcoin security model, which I think is poorly understood. I think that there's a lot of big question marks about it, especially regarding the transition to fee-based security. One of the concepts that people sometimes talk about is the security budget. Like, for example, I think Paul Stork talks about this. I know that there's a great paper on Bitcoin security model by Hasu, James Prestwich, and Brandon Curtis that referred to a security budget. And the security budget is like this idea of like how much Bitcoin or how much money is spent on Bitcoin security that is paid to miners every year. And some people get really upset at the concept of a security budget because they don't think it is meaningful for security. And because they think like the word suggests that you should like set it in advance. I'm sympathetic to one of those in that I think it is an important concept to understand Bitcoin security model. But I do think the word budget isn't great, because like, when you think of a budget, you think of something that's predetermined and set, like we're going to spend this much on this. It's, you know, a company will set a budget for marketing, for example. And part of the mining reward, that is funds that are paid out to miners, comes from transaction fees, which is a market rate. That's not decided in advance. That's how much are people willing to pay for block space, how much is block space worth, essentially. And so because of that, I don't think the word budget is a great term for it. And so I was just looking for a different kind of word that still captures this like total mining rewards over the course of a year, for example. Especially as a percentage of total Bitcoin supply out there, I think is a meaningful thing. So it was great. I got a lot of cool, funny responses and thoughtful ones. Like I think proof of work expenditure was an interesting one. But right now, my favorite one is from AJ Towns. He was like, why don't you just like make it like an acronym? You could do like rewards as percentage of supply. You can call it the Rappos factor. So that's I don't know why you're laughing. This is a very serious
topic. It's not a good acronym.
This is
not a good acronym.
Rappos. Why is it not? What?
After you hear it for the thousandth time, it just rolls off the tongue.
You're gonna love it.
Why does Rappos? What's wrong with that?
It sounds so Latino. I love it.
I know, or like, or Greek. You know.
Yes.
Like, or it could be Rapoi.
I don't have a better idea. It's interesting. Like, I don't want to go too deep.
I'm glad you acknowledge that.
We're close to an hour. But this is a big thing that people should be talking about. Long-term security budget.
I thought we were like 20 minutes in.
No.
We have got another 40 to go. Okay, I got another question for you. No, I'm kidding.
Why are we stopping at an hour? This is good. Let's keep this going.
You can keep going as long as you want.
I think the security budget is like a really interesting question. I think it's like, as far as I'm concerned, I agree with Matt Corallo on this, that Bitcoin is an experiment until we figure that out. And I don't think it's likely. I haven't sold any of my coins because of this research, but it is plausible that within a few decades, Bitcoin as it currently works might not be sustainable. It's possible.
Mario, is it
a lot of
Go ahead. No, finish. I thought you
were. I was just going to say, a lot of people are super confident one way or another. Like, there are people who have left Bitcoin, like, yeah, fees can't possibly sustain, like, provide enough security. And then there are people on the other side, they're like, oh, it's impossible that fees could be too low for Bitcoin to be secure. I think, honestly, anyone who expresses extreme confidence either way is their position is unjustified. I think we need a lot more research into this. And, yeah, there's a few of us chugging away at it, but I think you could use some more attention and not, like, angry. You shouldn't be thinking about this attention, which sometimes happens. But I'm kind of in the process right now of defining terms a lot better and making things a lot more concrete so we can analyze them.
Isn't it fair to say that if Bitcoin rips to, like, $1 million a coin, that the fee structure should pay to secure the network? Like, the value would be so great that you know, whatever that little fraction of whatever that fraction of a Bitcoin is, it doesn't that make sense? Like, if the thing is still around in 30 years, isn't it either a million or zero at that point?
That's something I have to add on to that. I see where you're getting at, but I thought about this. I keep thinking about this. As more Bitcoin is being moved to Lightning, for instance, there's going to be less and less appetite to make on-chain transactions. And in that case, then you're going to have less miners fees that are going to be rewarded to miners that are simply mining Bitcoin and building the blocks and adding the transactions onto that. So that's the one thing that is hard for me to grasp long-term. And no, I mean,
Mario, here we go. Let him have it.
All right. I was so excited. I was like, great. Len's going to answer my question, but I think you got it backwards, Len. Because once blocks, like, think about the types of transactions that are going over Lightning. It's small transactions.
Transitory stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They did a very large one recently. They did a record transaction. I forget the number. It was multiples of Bitcoins were sent over.
In the grand scheme, though, it's still not that big.
Hold up. Right. So you have this. So Lightning is going to do two things, essentially. Lightning allows you to send Bitcoin transactions off chain. So some demand for block space is going to move over there. But Lightning is also going to generate a lot of demand. There are a lot of transactions that are happening on Lightning that wouldn't have otherwise happened on Bitcoin. And you need to open and close channels. So when blocks are not full, if a lot of the transaction activity in blocks is are these, like, small, fast transactions that, you know, you're only going to do if it costs a few cents, then sure, allowing people to do Lightning network transactions will probably, like, might siphon some of those away and result in less block space used. However, if we get to the point in the future where it costs a few dollars to send a transaction, which I think we need to get to if Bitcoin's going to be secure, a lot of those transactions of the Lightning would have been happening anyways. So that stuff would have gotten priced out from the main chain anyways. And Lightning's going to generate a lot of demand for the kind of instant transactions. Also, think of it this way. How much money are you going to pay for block space if you can send one transaction versus how much money are you willing to pay if that transaction opens up a channel that will let you send thousands of payments? You're probably going to be willing to pay more in the second case. So from that perspective, I think it's pretty likely that Lightning is going to be net positive for Bitcoin fees in the long run. In the short term, there might be some back and forth on it, but once blocks fill up, and I have pretty high confidence that they will in the next few years, like, and I mean consistently full blocks, at that point, Lightning is almost surely a net positive for fees. I want to get back to Joey's question, though, because it was really good. I said, like, it's possible in a few decades, fees aren't high enough, or, you know, subsidies not high enough. And you were like, well, if Bitcoin goes to the moon, then, like, even a small percentage of it in subsidy will be really high. There's two problems with that. First of all, if you're correct, that just kicks the can down the road. Eventually, subsidy goes to zero. And if we were to know that Bitcoin's going to be worthless in the year 2140, that would probably trickle back, right? We're going to want greater certainty than that. Like, at best, that argument just says, well, I guess our grandkids will worry about it instead of our kids, right? Which isn't very satisfying to me. But the other problem with that is that as the value of the Bitcoin network grows, the incentive to attack it grows. So you're not only concerned about absolute security, you're concerned about relative security.
Let me stop you. If the value of the network grows, is the incentive to attack it really going to grow, or is there some kind of flashpoint where the incentive to attack it decreases because more people are involved in the network? The value and the involvement grows together, and so there is some kind of overlay there where the demand for attack is no longer growing; it's shrinking as more people adopt. Right.
But the demand for attack. How do I put this? demand for something isn't reduced by other people not wanting that. For example, if I really hate apples, that doesn't make the cost of apples go down as long as everyone else still wants it, right? So just because more people like Bitcoin, it doesn't mean that people who are economically opposed to it will want to attack it less. You could argue that means there's going to be more of us that will try to take actions to protect Bitcoin. That's valid. And maybe that's why there's more people like doing research on the security model, or there's more of us are going to try to build services to increase the value of blocks based on security. But the incentive to attack it does go up, right? If there's some, like, you know, like this is why even when Bitcoin's absolute security, like, so the absolute security and relative security. Absolute is just how much it is in dollar value, how much it costs to attack in dollar value, and there's relative security, how much it costs to attack relative to the economic value of Bitcoin. And the absolute security was like really low, like in Bitcoin's early days. Like you could have really fucked with Bitcoin early on, but there wasn't an incentive to do it because, you know, the economic value was quite small. Now there's a much, much higher incentive to attack Bitcoin. Like, for example, if Bitcoin was big enough right now that it, like, let's say this hyper-Bitcoinization was happening and it was like really threatening kind of the US dollar, you could argue it already is in some ways. But if it was like big enough that like Americans were moving over en masse to Bitcoin, like, do you think the United States government will be able to afford an attack on Bitcoin right now? It's hard to say. It may not, right? Yeah. But my point is that we're going to want higher security than we have now.
That, like,
if the future of Bitcoin is that big.
Yeah.
So I've done some analysis on this, and this is going way into the weeds here. But if you look at the U.S. naval fleet, they have less than 100 ships that are nuclear powered. And I've done the mathematics. It only takes a fraction of that less than 100 ships to generate enough power to overpower the Bitcoin network to do a 51% attack. But the problem remains is how do they gather the amount of ASICs required to do a 51% attack? It's very hard right now to get an order of ASICs. I mean, maybe not now. Everyone's selling. But a few months ago, it was very hard to find a bunch of ASICs. How are they going to be able to get so much and do it under the radar to a point that nobody's going to know about it, but then automatically put it on and do a 51% attack? I think it's logistically, it's very difficult to do. It's possible, but it's very difficult. That's just my analysis.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, exactly. It's not just the cost of electricity. It's kind of funny. A lot of like academic, papers on Bitcoin security model found over the last 10 years, it was insecure, which is like, kind of funny. Like,
how'd that go?
It obviously hasn't been, right? But part of it was the reason that they just looked at the cost of electricity. That was a very common mistake. And this is why the paper I mentioned earlier, with from Hasu, Prestwich, and Curtis, I think is quite good because it looks into other like economic costs. Like, you know, if like miners, for example, like they have to spend all this money, you know, not only acquiring the ASICs, but then, pre-purchasing power agreements, setting up these like warehouses and operating them. There's actually a lot of costs go into it. And, so it's not just Bitcoin in, you know, and then you spend it on electricity. There's a lot more to it. But the thing is it's quite complex and we don't understand it well enough. The thing is though, if fees never go up, like eventually subsidy becomes negligible and then the network is insecure. The thing is, we don't know at what threshold we could expect, you know, the incentive for attacks to get greater than the costs. But hopefully, if a few more of us keep chugging away at it, we can get to a clear look at that. You know, I don't think we'll ever reach a point where we know, this is the precise threshold we need to stay at. But I think we can probably, you know, get the upper and lower bounds of that a bit tighter.
We just got rug pulled here. Joey has to go and
You guys keep going. I'll pull myself out the stream. I got guests here. This is a good conversation, Mario. I would love to have
bring him on more often. Bring him on. What do they have to say?
Yeah, about... my wife, her friend, and her boyfriend from her fiance from the UK.
Your wife's friends. Okay, I misheard you there. you should ask what. I thought you said my wife and her.
Do they know Gandalf?
It's funny. My wife's friend is a lawyer. Who's just about to get her license here in Canada. So she's actually she's the CBP in-house legal team. We send her all our contract, all our agreements.
Review. Nice. Yeah. I've indirectly spoken with her. All right.
That's right. No, but listen, right.
Tell her hello from Ledin. Yeah.
Do you guys want to keep going or should we call it? It's up to you guys.
We can call it. I actually got to run.
We'll call it.
I also have friends. I promise.
Hey, listen, we saw you out at the bar. I know you got at least one other friend. So Mario, I'll say, you know, thank you for coming on. Thank you, as you mentioned, for your open lines of communication with Ledin. I'll mention that, you know, we've taken a bit of heat, I think, for suggesting people use Ledin as a platform. And I stand by that. I think that you guys have been really, really good on transparency, really, really good on reasonable yields, really, really good on appearances on the show, even before you were a sponsor. And I just don't know, you know, if there was ever a time where you want to be maximizing your Bitcoin sort of inputs, this is the time. And I think Ledin's a good way to do that. We only take sponsors that we really think are good ways to utilize your hard-earned corn stash. And I think you guys are one. So thank you for that. But I was also going to say that, you know, we'd love to have you back on soon to talk about some of this other stuff that's going on. Because like I said, you're a great follow on Twitter, Mario_Gibney. Lots of good content, lots of good commentary, and the Unhashed podcast, of course. Am I missing anything? Do you want to do a handoff? You've been on the show like 5 or 6 times now. I don't know if you want to really talk about like
he's leading the league in terms of appearances.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Number one, baby. I've always been your guest with the most appearances, I think.
Yeah,
I think that's
you were one of our first.
I was your first. I contacted you guys. I saw your show on Reddit, and I was like, "These guys seem cool. I think I'm gonna go places." No, you nailed it. Look at my Twitter account. Check out Ledin.io. I shield Gunash podcast a bunch. Check out my pinned tweet. I wrote an essay about how Bitcoin has two economic goods. Check it out. I would love to hear feedback on that. It's kind of setting that up. Yeah. That's me.
We love it. Mario,
I'm not cutting my hair.
Don't cut it. I'm not cutting mine either. Summer's for long hair. God bless you. Thanks everyone for coming. Thanks for your questions. We'll see you next week, Monday night. Adios.
Take care.
Way to go.